This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up this hour, we will sit down with Cuba's ambassador to the United States. Then we'll hear why a quick answer doesn't always mean an honest answer. Also, what researchers learned about the state of learning in America by spending hundreds of hours shadowing students in dozens of the nation's best high schools. That's coming up on Top of Mind. It's great to have you with us. Since President Donald Trump took office, he has steadily reimposed sanctions and travel restrictions on Cuba that the Obama administration had lifted. Recently, the Trump administration has imposed additional sanctions because of Cuba's support for the Maduro government in Venezuela. Cuba, Russia, and China continue to back Nicolas Maduro, while the U.S., the European Union, and most Latin American countries recognize opposition leader Juan Guaido as Venezuela's interim president, and they would like Maduro to step down. I'm joined in studio by Cuba's ambassador to the United States, Jose Cabañas. He is here as a guest of BYU's International Vice President. Thank you for coming by, Ambassador.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for your time.
Why does Cuba remain supportive of Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela?
Well, the answer is more complex than the question itself. Our bilateral ties with Venezuela are long-lasting. I mean, I explain from time to time that the first country that Fidel Castro visited immediately after the Cuban Revolution was to Venezuela, considering the support we got from Venezuelans to fight our war of independence and freedom. And particularly with the government of Comandante Chavez, you remember he came to power in 98, and since then we developed bilateral ties. The same way we have been doing with many countries in the world. Now, why this is coming now as an argument to change the policy in regards to Cuba? Well, we do believe it's an argument. Before that argument, you had some people talking about health incidents of American diplomats in Cuba.
Right. There were some concerns that there had been some sort of sonic attack or on American diplomats in the embassy in Cuba.
We know, and your people know very well, that it never happened. Mm-hmm. FBI was the designee agency to go to Cuba and to do their own research, and they did it freely. And if you ask them, they will tell you what they found. I mean, nothing to sustain that your diplomats were under attack. Then suddenly, by early 2019, you have a new argument, which is our presence, our role in Venezuela.
And when you say argument, you're referring to this. You believe that the Trump administration is using Cuba's support of Venezuela as justification for additional sanctions and for attempts to isolate Cuba.
Absolutely. We come from a moment, I mean, 2015, 2016, those were years where we discuss as equals with respect and reciprocity.
During the Obama administration.
During the Obama administration. It could have happened before. It was not our fault, but it happened during the Obama administration. And finally, what you had in the United States was a fatigue about the arguments of embargo or blockade, as we call it, against Cuba. I mean, many people, Republicans and Democrats, independents, they realized that the policy was failing. I mean, after 60 years, you got basically no
60 years of restriction on travel from America to the United States, on restriction on trade,
everything.
Sanctions. That was failing, you say. The United States wasn't getting after 60 years.
If you ask to most of the politicians and to the scholars, they will tell you, and there are many papers written saying basically that, and people talking in Congress, this is a failed policy. I mean, that was under agreement on any leader, under any leader in government and in Congress as well, and the population, I mean, the states, legislators or governors, then it's a failed policy. Let's change it. And we had the opportunity to negotiate and to discuss, again, as equals for the first time.
Mm-hmm. Again, in 2015 and 2016.
That's right. On those many issues in which we had to have agreement, coming from environment to health, to law enforcement, which is very meaningful for the United States, and at the same time on those issues that we will never ever have an agreement because we come from different past, different history, different priorities. We decided to go ahead, even if you had still a sanction regime on Cuba. I mean, the Helms-Burton legislation was alive as it is today. Although
this is legislation that...
It codifies the whole system of sanctions against Cuba. It was passed in 1996.
Congress passed legislation that codifies, all of these sanctions against
Cuba. That's right. Even if you have a military presence in Cuba that we don't accept, I mean, a Guantanamo Bay, most people know that you have a prison there, but most people don't know that that was a base that was imposed against our will that remains there. And we always ask you to simply to leave because that's a piece of Cuba and we have sovereignty on that. Even if you have projects and programs that are funded with federal money to produce a regime change in Cuba. In the middle of all of those circumstances, we say, let's negotiate, let's reopen bilateral ties because they will benefit people in the United States and people in Cuba as well.
What would be the benefit to Cuba to reopen the bilateral trade and relationships in Cuba? What has the effect been, for example, of the restriction of Americans and starting this summer, U.S. cruise ships not allowed to dock in Cuba? How has that affected the people of Cuba?
Well, first, we are neighbors. We are very close to each other.
To Florida, yes.
Yes. Surely. No, and United States
US
in general.
States.
You are a leading economy in the world. And the problem with what you call embargo and we call blockade is this is not a bilateral issue here. You have your federal agencies coming after any Cuban bank transaction. You have your federal agencies telling other companies not to do business with Cuba.
Other companies from other countries, and in fact, this is happening right now with oil coming from Venezuela that may be coming
from several places, and that's why most of those countries they pass local legislation called antidote legislation to prevent Hans Burton from applying in their own. I mean, extraterritorial effects of the Hans Burton.
Which is the U.S.
legislation, yes.
The U.S. sanctions law.
And then that affects a lot. We calculate every year the cost of the blockade against Cuba, and we publish a report that we provide the United Nations about the impact. Then if you change a little bit, at least, the status quo, and you have companies doing business with Cuba, people more freely to come, which is not only tourism, as some people portray that. We are talking about the universities coming to Cuba, research centers coming to Cuba. We have the chance to expand the cultural exchange. People at both ends, they benefit. And not only Cuba, people in the United States. Some organizations, they have calculated how much money you lose under the embargo because there are businesses that you are not doing. How many job posts you create simply by doing business with Cuba. I have been explaining here and in other places the Mariel project, which is a deep water container terminal.
This is a port?
It's a port in northern Cuba, very close to your ports in the south. Well, 9 American ports, they have signed so far MOUs with Mariel, simply because they know that our port is instrumental in transshipping in the Caribbean. After the Panamanian finished what they do in the canal, now we are able to host those large ships and to do transshipping there. This is simply an example. We have others.
Ambassador Cabanas, you're making an argument for, first of all, saying that Cuba is ready and willing to establish economic relations and travel relations, and this would benefit both the United States and Cubans. The Trump administration has sent a very clear message that And there are many who agree with the Trump administration that having any kind of warmer relation with Cuba would be an acceptance of human rights violations that Cuba is alleged of, torture of prisoners, unacceptable prison conditions, the jailing of political dissidents, the suppression of free speech. How do you respond to those who say, you know, as long as Cuba is not doing those things, we should not be having, you know, warm economic relations with this nation?
Well, as you said, those are alleged crimes. You have arguments in the media for many years. In the 60s, your reason for not doing business with Cuba was the Soviet Union and the Socialist China. In the 80s.
Was their support of Cuba that,
yeah,
that was
in
the
80s was our presence and our role in Africa. Not a clue about Venezuela or anything else.
Uh-huh.
And then suddenly, 80s and 90s, people talking about human rights, which is a concept that, if you remember, not human rights, but civil rights in the United States was a bad word in the 60s. If you have people in the States that they don't like or that they are not pleased with a few things happening in Cuba, we can tell you we have many people that are not pleased with many things that have happened in the United States. Mm. I mean, the social indicators, and you have, there is a debate in the United States about education, free education, or global health as a right in the United States. We don't have that debate in Cuba. It's a right, it's a human right.
To have free education,
and we provide
free and health care.
Yes, and health care and education with quality. It's not only that is for free, but the quality that you provide. Then my point is, in your political system, you have many things that we don't like. In our political system, we have things that you don't like. My point is, foreign policy has to be consistent. You have nice bilateral ties with countries that they don't have political parties, that they consider women less important than an animal. If your foreign policy, not currently, but historically, were to be consistent, you should have an embargo on each of those countries. But on the other hand, you are saying that some people agree with this administration. What I can tell you scientifically is that every poll that is conducted in the United States about Cuba, the large majority of the population among Cuban Americans, support better ties with Cuba. No doubts about that.
José Ramón Cabañas is Ambassador of the Republic of Cuba to the United States. Thank you very much, Ambassador, for speaking with me today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your time.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, the kind of learning that high school students really need, but most are not getting in American schools. Just ahead, we'll learn how quickly people can come up with a lie. Ciara Hewlett has that conversation.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. If you ask someone a question and they answer quickly, that must mean they're telling the truth, right? Because they don't have time to come up with a lie and the first thing that comes to your head is the truth? Well, not necessarily. Turns out that people can and will lie when under pressure to make themselves look good. John Protzko is a psychology postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and he joins me on the line now. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Sarah.
Where did this idea come from in the first place, that the first thought that comes into your mind is going to be truthful?
Me and my lab had had some findings that seemed to be consistent with this idea that, well, people are kind of giving the wrong answer when asked to answer quickly, but the standard paradigmatic answer in psychology for the use of this sort of answer quickly method is, well, it's because you're getting at some aspect of the hidden mind. But we just said, well, what if that's not the case? What if by asking people to answer quickly, you're simply giving them the opportunity to tell you what they think you want to hear?
Yeah, because for 100 years, psychology has used that as a method to test people. Just think of the first thing. Like, don't think, just what's the first thing that comes to your mind, right?
Exactly. And the belief has been, and still is in many ways, that it takes people time to come up with the socially desirable answer, the lie. Sort of the downside of giving people time to think about something. So generally in a lot of psychology type scales and surveys, you'll see instructions like, just say the first thing that comes to mind. And the idea is like, well, that they don't have time to come up with the nice lie, so that's going to be the true answer.
Yeah, and I've seen a lot of personality tests that will do that too. So why did you decide to question that belief? Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm just trying to think of the right way to answer.
Oh, no, you're fine.
there have been a number of other findings in the literature that have sort of this standard answer that, like, when you ask people to answer quickly, like, so for example, in moral decision-making, like, should you kill one person to save five people? If you ask them to answer quickly, then they'll tell you, no, don't kill one person to save five people. And the standard interpretation of that is, well, you know, it's because people's initial response is to be good, and then it takes time to override that and kind of give, like, the cold, dark answer, the utilitarian answer. But those are all just assumptions. So we decided, well, why don't we test some of these assumptions?
And what did you find?
We found that when sort of you put people under time pressure, the thing that they do is when you ask them to answer quickly, they will give you sort of the pretty lie. They'll tell you the thing that they think you want to hear.
So it's not going down into that deeper self that's going to give the truth immediately, like
right.
People used to think. So I want to give our listeners a chance to test this out for themselves. So could you read us a question, and then we'll have just those listening just answer it just as quick as you can.
Sure. Here's my favorite one. No matter who I'm talking to, I'm always a good listener.
And if they answered true or false, which one would be more likely the lie?
So when people have time to think about it, they generally say false, because, you know, it's like not every single person, not every time. It's not I'm not always a good listener. But when asked quickly, you say, okay, you have to answer now as fast as you can. No matter who I'm talking to, I'm always a good listener, true or false. People go, yeah, true.
Right.
Even though it's false, like all of the questions that we ask on this social desirability scale are all false by definition. Like, there's never a case that people are always willing to admit when they made a mistake. But that's one of the questions. I'm always willing to admit it. And none of these things are true, but by saying them, you're kind of presenting yourself in a socially desirable way.
Could you give us a couple more examples of the questions that you asked?
Sure. So I'm always willing to admit it when I make a mistake is one. I've never deliberately said something that hurt someone's feelings is another one. That one's particularly good, I think.
Yeah, because we've all done something like that.
absolutely. There's never been a time when I was quite jealous of the good fortune of others.
Hmm.
So these are all lies. To say, like, yes, that's true of me is a lie. And it'd be a lie of anybody, but it does make us look good to say that.
Are these questions deliberately written to kind of make people squirm a little bit?
they're deliberately written and constructed as a scale to get at this idea of socially desirable responding, to sort of say, like, these are all lies, but if you tell me yes, I know, and the number of items that you tell me yes to is sort of a degree of how much you're willing to lie to put on a good face. Now, these questions, they kind of have a very clear answer, but it's generally not true. But when you ask people things like, do you think the current administration is doing a good job? Like, they may have a belief, but they want to present themselves really well, and you don't know what they're telling you, to what extent is it because they're trying to look good, or they're trying to put on a good face, or whatever it is. So it's in attitude research and beliefs research, there's always this problem of socially desirable responding.
Do you think in your study that people were lying on purpose, or is it just this natural response that the first thing you're going to try and look good, and you're not attempting to lie?
Right. I think it's entirely an attempt to look good. The fact that the answer to these questions are all lies is sort of a fun quirk, but really the underlying idea is you're trying to present yourself in a good way. And people, on average, they do agree to, you know, like three or four of these items. So it's not like everyone, like when you give people time to respond or think about it, they say no to all of them. Like, people still kind of give you a little bit. They want to look good. But when you make them answer quickly, that's when you're seeing, like, their default response is to say, like, yeah, I'm good. I'm a good person.
Do you think these people could be thinking that they're actually telling the truth because they think deep down that that's their true self, that they're a good person?
Yeah, so we did do a second study in this work where we tested that idea of, because it had to do with the extent to which you think people deep down are really good. And it turns out that when you give people time to think and time to answer these questions, that the more you think that, like, people are good deep down, kind of the more you're willing to lie. and say, like, yeah, you know, I don't do these things. Excuse me. But when you give time pressure, everyone's affected. It, like, it doesn't matter if you think people are good or bad. Like, everyone is just kind of affected equally, to the extent that you're going to increase the likelihood that you're going to give these pretty lies to make yourself look good.
So what's the takeaway here, that we shouldn't trust people that answer questions quickly?
No. This work is really about a method. It's about the method that's used in psychology, it's used in sociology, it's used in survey research, about answering quickly. And there's kind of this big belief that it gives you sort of secret access to the mind. And it might not necessarily do that. One of the things it is doing is it's making people lie to you. So other research that might want to use this method, it's a very popular method of sort of answer quickly, there's something that has to be kept in mind, that there's a possibility that the responses that you're getting are not sort of secret underlying mental events, but really they're just kind of like a pretty lie that's being told.
What do you hope will happen as a result of your research? Do you hope that it'll kind of turn around the world of surveys and statistics?
I hope that it's just an example of examining some of the underlying assumptions that we have, and that future research, it may be very valuable to keep using this method. And this method of asking people to answer quickly may indeed be doing other things other than just getting people to lie to you, getting people to give you the socially desirable answer. So I kind of hope that it keeps being used in that way, but mindful of this other possibility that maybe there's something else coming along with using this method than just social desirability.
People might be just trying to make themselves look good.
Right.
John Protzko is a psychology postdoctoral scholar at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sarah.
I'm Ciara Hewlett. This is Top of Mind. Next, the kind of learning that high school students really need, but most aren't getting.
Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Think back to high school for a moment, if you can bear it. Where did you do your most engaged learning? Was it in a particular subject or with a particular teacher? Maybe it wasn't even in a class, but during extracurricular activity. That's how it was for me. I worked on the school newspaper. No big surprise there, I guess. Education researcher Sarah Fine spent hundreds of hours shadowing high school students in some of the nation's very best schools to figure out the special ingredients for what she calls deeper learning. The book she co-wrote about that research is In Search of Deeper Learning, The Quest to Remake the American High School. And she's with us now. Sarah Fine, thanks for taking time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Describe a deeper learning situation that you witnessed in one of these schools you studied.
Sure. Well, since you started with the question about where deeper learning happens in high schools, no spoiler alert here, that one of the things that my co-author and I found is that there's a lot more powerful learning happening in places that are not necessarily at the academic core of high school. So we spent a lot of time in one particular school following a student theater production. So it was happening after school, but it was on site. And what we saw in this production was that kids were incredibly engaged and focused, that they really knew why they were there, what their role was, and their roles were different from each other, of course. So you had, you know, you had the lights and the stage manager and the actual actors and the student who was supporting the director of the show. And so kids really knew what their job was and how their different jobs worked together in service of putting up a really great show. And so the sort of vibe and ethos of that space was just much more conducive to engaged and deep learning than a lot of the academic courses that we saw.
But deep learning how? What? I mean, what were they learning that was like so much deeper than what they were getting in chemistry class?
Well, in this case, it was around how do you sort of pull the pieces of a theater production together in a way and tell a particular story, in this case, you know, their interpretation of a given play, in a way that reaches an audience and sends a message that is powerful and compelling and engaging. And so, you know, and then there was a lot of skills that were being learned along the way, including things like, you know, how do you coordinate the lights with the characters given a recent decision to slow down a scene in order to sort of heighten the humor. You know, so they were really playing the game of what it meant to sort of mount a production, in this case, a theatrical production, but it's not that different from mounting, say, a movie production. And in the same way that you, when I'm imagining when you were working on your school newspaper, kind of had a sense of urgency around producing high quality work under deadline, that was very similar here, that kids really felt like, you know, they had to step up because the show was going up on a certain day and there was nothing to do except kind of put their all into it.
Deeper learning then is hands-on learning, or it's some sort of like real world mastery of real world problems?
Yeah, that's part of it. So my co-author Jel Mehta and I define deep learning as emerging at the intersection of creativity, identity, and mastery. So the mastery part has to do with like the real deep skills and knowledge that kids are developing when they're engaged in deep learning. But there's also a piece around, to your point, around kind of doing something creative, producing something new that hasn't been done before. So it's different than like taking the same chemistry test that kids have been taking in 11th grade at the end of the semester for the last 20 years. So there's a creative component. And then there's also the piece around seeing yourself as a real participant in the field. So kids who are doing theater really saw themselves as theater kids. It was sort of not just peripheral to who they were. It was a deep part of who they were, the same way that the newspaper kids talked about themselves like that and potentially saw themselves going into careers in journalism. So I think there's a bunch of different components. It's not just about hands-on. It's also about minds and hearts. But definitely a piece of that has to do with sort of doing something, not just learning about it.
Clearly, and I guess I can speak from personal experience, having these kinds of situations in high school where you're really engaged, where you feel like you're actually exploring possible selves, you know, possible futures for yourself, you know, that's great for me, for students. But why is it necessary in turn when we think about what the school system in America needs to be providing? I mean, we still really need our students to be proficient at math and be able to write well and understand English grammar and,
absolutely,
you know, have a proficiency in American history and global history, right? Why does this deeper learning component of it, where you're having a lot of fun being a theater kid, why does that matter so much?
Well, what we would argue is that the key question is not, you know, just how to get more experiences like theater into schools, but how do we get some of the qualities that theater or newspaper have into core academic classes? Because to your point, obviously there is, you know, a foundation of knowledge and skills that we know to be important both for success in college and beyond in adult life. And, you know, I would be the last to say we should abandon the traditional disciplines. But our question is, what can traditional disciplines learn about engaged learning, and how can we get richer, more powerful experiences into those classes? And so, for example, to go back to chemistry, we saw some really powerful science classes where, by contrast to a lot of science classes that we saw where the way we describe it is that kids were kind of practicing science appreciation more than doing science. Like they, you know, they're like touring through the textbook, all the things that have been learned about this, that, or the other, and sort of repeating it back, or repeating back particular formulas that they've been taught to use. They're actually doing science in the context of their science classroom. So they are, they're not learning about the scientific process as, you know, something that can be represented on one page of a textbook, 1 through 5. They're actually engaged in asking questions to which they don't know the answers, which is exactly what scientists do, right? Scientists don't spend their time exploring what is already known. They're interested in the unknown. And so, you know, kids aren't doing that with the level of sophistication that somebody who has a graduate degree in chemistry might do. But they really were engaging in the process that mirrored that. And so,
okay, so let me just have you pause right here. I want you to be even more specific about a classroom that you might have seen where this deeper learning is happening. Because I imagine that every teacher who might be listening at this moment is nodding their head and going, well, yeah, I do that. Like, we have group discussions where I ask them, well, what's the next question we would ask? And let's talk about this. And why is the sky blue? You know, and let's puzzle through this and let's see if we can figure out an answer. I mean, that's like fundamental to, you know, leading a good engaged classroom discussion, planning hands-on activities that will give the students an opportunity to experiment and to learn through doing. It seems to me like you're talking about something beyond that, but I'm unclear what the next level of deeper learning actually is.
Yeah, well, I think I have two responses to that. First, it's less common than you might think, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So my colleague and I spent time at 30 different schools around the country, and we also dug very deeply into sort of large-scale data that describes what happens in American classrooms. And the story that emerged both from our own time and from those data sets is a pretty depressing one, in fact, that kids are not getting a lot of time to do hands-on engaging work. Kids are not particularly engaged in discussions or sort of rich thinking in classrooms. So we know that 4 out of 5 high school classrooms in the U.S. Are sort of dominated by worksheet, sort of recall and regurgitate type work. And so I think, unfortunately, maybe there's a lot of work to be done just in terms of getting our core classrooms to be sort of more engaging at a superficial level to kids. And also, I think the piece that you're getting at around sort of what if we kind of exploded the whole thing and did things differently is something that we saw in some of the project-based schools where we spent time. So project-based learning, you know, aspires to get kids sort of doing authentic work that has a real audience for the work and to embed the building of skills and knowledge inside of that. And so, for example, I saw a project-based classroom where 11th graders were working in collaboration with the California Innocence Project, which is a group of pro bono lawyers who work to try to exonerate folks who might have been wrongly convicted. And those 11th graders were digging really deeply into questions around the nature of the justice system in the U.S., mass incarceration, what those patterns mean and why they might have come to be. But they also were working on behalf of potential exonerees, going through open cases that had not yet been resolved, trying to help the lawyers make decisions about which cases were worth taking up. And so they had a real
client. Was that
a
civics class or was it a history class? What was that class?
This was a humanities class, so combined English and social science. So a lot of project-based schools are kind of exploding some of the boundaries that traditionally separate disciplines, you know, out of the belief that a lot of the work in the 21st century world in adult life does not sort of fall along the lines of like English science. A lot of us sort of work at the boundaries of various disciplines. Okay. So kids were reading, they were writing, they were speaking, they were developing literacy skills, but they were also doing work with a real audience and a real purpose. And so they were deeply engaged in it, as well as engaged in kind of more conventional classic questions around exploring literature and sort of reading, in this case, Bryan Stevenson's memoir called Just Mercy.
Sarah Fine, I know that you actually head up an apprenticeship program for teachers at High Tech High's Graduate School of Education, trying to help teachers know how to do this in the classroom. If a teacher is not in one of these project-based settings, they're just in your regular high school setting where the classes are 50 minutes long and there might be 6 of them during a day and you maybe have them every other day or whatever, right? Like standard. What kinds of skills does a teacher need to be able to bring deeper learning to that kind of a classroom setting?
Mm-hmm. Well, so the first thing I think I would say is they really need to connect with their own relationship with the discipline that they're teaching. So if they're teaching English, for example, what is it that turns them on as a human, not necessarily just as a teacher, about the discipline? Are they an avid reader or consumer of news, or maybe they're part of an amateur theater company, or maybe they were a journalist in college, etc. So what is their personal relationship with the field? And then trying to imagine bringing their kids into that field in ways that are sort of authentic to the work of the field, rather than feeling beholden to, like, you know, have kids write the 13th five-paragraph essay they've written in the year. So really trying to look to the professional versions of the disciplines that they're teaching and really remember what it is that folks are doing out in the real world, and then bring some of that, those structures and aspirations into their classrooms rather than sort of doing school the way that has always been done. I think that's the first piece. And then more broadly, just sort of modeling real, genuine curiosity in what kids think, how they think, what they might be able to do under the right conditions, not seeing themselves as kind of the intermediaries between, like, here's a fixed body of knowledge and my job is to dump it into your brains, but sort of seeing themselves as sort of colleagues with their students in some sort of exploration that doesn't necessarily have a fixed destination. So there's a piece around kind of stance and, like, how you see yourself in the classroom. And then there's also a piece around what is it that you're undertaking to do with your kids and how does that match up to the real work that your discipline is connected to.
And if that kind of learning is going on every day in an English classroom somewhere in America in high school, are the kids in that classroom going to still be able to get a good grade on the year-end test that the school really cares about, because that's how the school is assessed in its district?
That's a great question. Not necessarily. And so I think we saw that some of the most skillful teachers that we spent time observing, and many of them did work in really traditional schools. They were not project-based places. They really used their political capital and their energy to buffer and defend what they were doing. They used themselves as a kind of buffer in between the students and what either the state or maybe the school was asking. They might be working with their administration to try to shift some of the assessments, or may sort of mount a case for why what kids were doing is actually, more powerfully aligned to what colleges and careers want than what the school might want. Because I think there's actually a lot of appetite to move away from tests that are sort of archaic, low level, sort of misaligned to our priorities. But everybody feels a little bit hamstrung, like, oh, well, we've always done it this way, or the state won't be flexible. But I think there's a lot of pleasant surprises in that. There's a lot of will to undertake that work when there's enough people doing it.
Did we did you tend to find this kind of learning happening more commonly in like magnet schools, alternative schools? You mentioned project-based schools. Did you see much of it in your typical public high school?
We did. So what we say in the book is that powerful learning or deep learning is happening everywhere. I mean, the good news is that every school we went to, regardless of how big or small, regardless of whether it was urban or suburban or well-resourced or poor, we found pockets of really powerful learning happening in classrooms. In some cases, in big schools, it was happening more sort of at a department level, like a whole group of teachers. The bad news is it was rarely happening across sort of a single school with coherence as an institution. And so that's where we did find that the smaller schools, not necessarily magnets, but ones that had kind of been designed from the start to have a particular set of values, were a little bit more promising in their ability to have a single vision of learning kind of govern across classrooms. But the good news is you know, even in the sort of oldest, stodgiest high schools, you know, the ones that, you know, their mascot is from 1921 or something, we still found pockets where teachers were engaging kids in really powerful work.
Did those teachers tend to be the younger teachers?
No. In fact, we have a chapter of our book where we sort of dive deeply and look at some cases of the most skillful teachers we saw that were not working in specialized schools. And all of them, their median age, I think, was 40. And all
of
them
for the deeper learning,
the
deeper learning teachers. That
yes. And I don't think that's a I don't think that should come across as a surprise, because while teaching for a long time is no guarantee that you're going to have deep practice, I do think that it takes a certain amount of maturity and skill to be ready to kind of reposition yourself as a teacher and let go of control a little bit and really see yourself as a colleague with your students rather as somebody who needs to kind of assert your power over them through your expertise.
Right. And what about graduation rates in schools where a lot of deep learning is happening?
Well, there are some. There is some study underway, not work that I'm doing directly, trying to link some schools that have particular values aligned to what we've been talking about, and trying to see whether those schools are in fact producing better outcomes in terms of college going and college retention. And there's some preliminary evidence that is positive on that front, but there's a lot more work to be done.
Just finally, in the final 30 seconds we've got or so, what's your advice to parents if they'd really like to make sure their kid is having at least one deeper learning experience in high school?
That's a great question. I think take a chance. I mean, I think a lot of parents, especially parents who themselves have gone to colleges, feel fearful of making choices that look different from the ones they themselves made. So, for example, choosing to let a kid take an elective course instead of another advanced placement course. And I think that if they really sort of slow down and think about what is going to be good for my kids' intellectual development and for their emotional development, I think they would, most parents, if they take the time, would kind of acknowledge to themselves that the thing preventing them from supporting their kid in that might be sort of fear about whether or not their kid can get into the right college rather than kind of a sense of what their kid's learning might be. And so, I think it would be a great decision if people could support that.
Sarah Fine, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah Fine's co-author of In Search of Deeper Learning, The Quest to Remake the American High School. Thanks for tuning into Top of Mind today. I'm Julie Rose. There was a time in my childhood when I thought I was going to be a scientist. But at some point, I became less confident that I could actually do that. Not not because of any specific skills, really. Just that I saw wacky Bill Nye and his kid science helpers on TV, and I didn't really see myself as that. Well, this happens a lot, especially with girls and minority students. According to research by New York University psychology professor Marjorie Rhodes, how we talk about science with kids can make a difference. Professor Rhodes joins me now on the line. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
So you found a big difference among elementary school kids who you studied between them thinking about being a scientist versus doing science. Explain the difference there. What's the distinction?
We did. So in our research, that project involved about 300 children from public elementary schools in Brooklyn and the Bronx. And we asked them three times across the course of the school year. We asked them either how much they want to be a scientist and how good they think they would be at being a scientist. Or for the other half of kids, we asked them, how much do you want to do science and how good do you think you would be at doing science? And we found that for kids who were asked how good they thought they would be at being a scientist, they became less and less confident about that possibility across the course of their school year. They were becoming less and less sure that that was something that they could do or that they were interested in doing. But for children who were asked if they wanted to do science, they remained confident all the way across the course of the school year. So children remained sure that they could do science even as they lost confidence that they could actually be a scientist.
What would be the difference in their mind? Yeah. What do you think is happening subconsciously?
We think that when children think about being a scientist, they think about needing to be a particular kind of person to succeed in science. And this can be problematic if children have reason to question if they are the right kind of person to be a scientist. And those reasons to question can come from social stereotypes, like you mentioned in the introduction. So if they think that scientists are usually white or usually male or usually from a certain high economic background, and those things don't match with how they see themselves, then that can give them a reason to question if they really are the right kind of person to be a scientist. Or even, honestly, if they are white and a boy and from a high economic background, but maybe they're just struggling with science, that struggle can also give them reason to question if they're the right kind of person to be a scientist. But when children think about doing science, then they think less about needing to be a particular kind of person and more about science as a series of activities that they can learn to do. And when they're just thinking about it that way, they're thinking about the activities that make up science, then they don't end up questioning if they're the right kind of person. They just focus on learning to do science.
Hmm. It reminds me a little bit about how we're told not to encourage our kids or like compliment them on being so smart, but to focus on their behaviors. You worked really hard in that class. I'm really pleased. Right? Does it connect there?
I think it does. Because both are really about categorization. So the problem, if you talk with kids about saying things like, oh, you're so smart today, then this sets up in their mind categories. So there are smart kids and not smart kids, or maybe days when I'm smart and days when I'm not smart, which is similar to what we think is being set up with the scientist language. When they hear scientist language, they think, okay, there's a category of scientists and a category of not scientists. And if children decide for whatever reason that they're in the not scientist group or that they're in the not smart group, then that's not really anything that they can do anything about because they're just not in the right group. But if instead we focus on behaviors and activities that people can do, then that's a lot more fluid. It's something children have more control over, and it's not such an exclusive idea that you have to be, you know, the right kind of person in order to do the thing.
Which kind of messaging are students getting more exposure to?
Yeah, so that's part of what motivated this. They are definitely getting more exposure to identity-focused language. So we've done an extensive analysis of children's media, particularly shows that focus about science. We've also done, so we just coded all the references to science that we could find in the scripts of children's television shows. We've also analyzed language that teachers produce in classrooms by recording them and coding it line by line for different references to science. And we've also analyzed the language that's used in like children's museum exhibits designed to teach about science. And across all three of those environments, children overwhelmingly hear identity-focused language. It's really common to say things to kids like, let's be scientists today, or come be a scientist with me, or scientists think about big ideas and get ideas of how to solve them. That's a quote from a Curious George episode teaching about scientists for preschool children. So the scientist way of talking, be a scientist, is overwhelming. And so we think that it's really important to show that actually that can be not very engaging way to talk to young children. I can see why it sounds engaging from an adult perspective. It sounds sort of exciting to pretend to be a scientist. So I see why adults would think that's a good way to talk to children. And I think most adults find it kind of counterintuitive to suggest that this is actually giving kids the idea that it's sort of an exclusive thing, who can be a scientist and who cannot be a scientist.
And it's especially problematic for children who are not in the majority?
That's right. Well, I think it becomes problematic when children have reason to question if they're a scientist, and those can come from social stereotypes. So groups that are underrepresented in science, which includes girls and also in our research, Black and Hispanic children are often underrepresented in science, and we have found bigger effects among girls and among African-American and Hispanic children. But I also think it can be problematic across the board because children can have other reasons to question if they're scientists too, which could come from beliefs about their economic background or could come from just their own experiences with difficulty or a lack of scientists role models in their families and so on. So I think generally the do science way of talking about it is more inclusive and engaging for everybody, but that might be more important the more barriers you face to entry into
what
science.
Would be some better messages then? Instead of saying, come be scientist, come be a scientist with me, what would you say instead?
So what we say instead is come do science. So it's very simple. The change is pretty simple, but it's also really important. So we say, come do science with me today. Doing science means designing experiments and learning about the world. We've created some pre-K lessons that use this language, and in those, we talk about the steps of doing science. So we say, doing science means using our senses to observe. Doing science means making guesses about what we think is going to happen next, and doing science means checking to see when our guesses are right and when they're wrong. And no matter how they turn out, that's all part of doing science, and we make new guesses and we keep going. You can present all of that same language in a be scientist way. So you can say being a scientist means making guesses and so on. But we have found that presenting those ideas in a do science way is more engaging to preschool children. And interestingly, this year we found that this year we did a study with teachers in the pre-K program in New York City. We have a pre-K, universal pre-K here, so all across the city. And we trained half of the teachers to use do science language, and then we recorded them to see if that training worked. And when teachers weren't in the training, they overwhelmingly, you know, said, come be scientists today to the students in their classroom. But if they went through the training, they could absolutely change what they said. So they then overwhelmingly said, come do science with me today. So although the do science language isn't really the norm right now, I think it's actually pretty easy to make it a habit once you get that idea in your head and you start practicing talking that way. So we didn't find that teachers had any trouble changing their language.
And do their students perform better on those tasks?
Actually. Yep. So what we did then is a few days after they participated in a science lesson with their teachers, we came back with our science games that were related in the content to the lesson that the teacher taught, and we looked to see how engaged the students were in these games, how long they kept playing with them even after they encountered setbacks, and how much they had learned about what the teacher had been trying to teach them. And we did find a benefit for students whose teachers had been trained to use more action-focused language.
They were just more engaged, more willing to stick it out. Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, one of the biggest things that we see a difference on is persistence following setbacks. So science, as we all know, involves making a lot of mistakes. You make a guess, you get something wrong, and you have to keep going. And that keep going after you make a mistake can be a really hard thing, well, for everybody, for grown-ups, and also for children. And we find that the action-focused mindset really helps children be willing to keep going even after, you know, they encounter a time when their guess was wrong.
It seems like that would be true of any field, not just science. You know, do writing instead of be a writer, or,
right,
you know, play tennis instead of be a tennis player.
I think that's right. And we have some similar findings looking at other aspects of children's behavior, too. I think it interacts with how strongly people think there's a particular kind of person can do the thing.
Oh, right. Like if there's already a stereotype or an identity.
Exactly. We have these like Einstein views of what a scientist looks like. And, you know, so that is something children are aware of really young, even before they really know what science is at all. They already
Marjorie Rhodes, thank you so much for your time. Good luck.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Marjorie Rhodes is a professor of psychology at New York University. You're tuned to Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. This hour, the advanced farming techniques of the Mayan people. Then, why parents should pay closer attention when their kids start to whine. And Maleficent Ursula, Mother Gothel, Dolores Umbridge, we will look at some of the best and most terrifying female villains on screen. ParentPreviews.com has that rundown for us. That's ahead on Top of Mind. Thanks for tuning in. Just how large were the ancient Mayan cities of Latin America? And how advanced were their farming practices? Those two things are connected because a civilization can only be as large as it has food to sustain itself, either by growing it or importing it. So that's why geoarchaeologist Tim Beach spends so much time puzzling over the Maya farming question. Recently, he and his team used airplanes equipped with radar to make some startling discoveries about the scale of Maya agriculture 1,000 years ago. Beach is a professor at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's on the line. Hi, thank you for taking time today, Professor Beach.
Hello, this is Tim Beach. It's good to talk with you.
What is this area that you're studying? Where is it in the world?
Well, I've studied all over the Maya world, and that runs from the Yucatan of Mexico southward into all the way to El Salvador. It includes a vast area with many, many ancient Maya cities. The current work focuses on the boundary between Mexico, Guatemala, and Belize. And this is where I've focused a lot of work because we have a very well-preserved tropical forest in an area called the Program for Belize, which is a private conservation area. And that has allowed us then to study what is now a thick tropical forest with multi-canopies and looks as wild as you could imagine, what the underlying Maya infrastructure was like. And we could only do that with this LIDAR, these laser pulses that were taken from a plane that just took a couple of days to map about 275 square kilometers. And we were able to see that it's a tropical forest, but underneath it is a vast Maya agricultural system and a lot of cities and all the houses and causeways that are associated with that are mounds and causeways.
So if I'm understanding, one of the challenges of trying to study Mayan civilization is that a lot of it right now is covered up by trees, thick forests, so you can't just sort of like walk around out there and be like, oh, here's a mound and here's a canal.
Well, those are great points and great questions. And we did that for many years because we had this great place to study, and we were, you know, we're a combination of geologists and ecologists and also archaeologists. And you can't really study any one of those other things without the other two involved with it. And so we would indeed, exactly as you describe it, go out in these long transects. We'd cut with machetes trails through the forest, and then find things like evidence of an ancient city or ancient mound and so forth, and then laboriously excavate and map around it underneath 30, 40, 50 meters of tree canopy. Hmm. And we were able also to fly over in small planes before, and where the forest gave way to savannas, then we could see some of the underlying patterns. And about 20 years or so ago, we found these remarkable canal systems that added up to about a square kilometer or so. And we studied them for years, and we studied them with a lot of different scientists, trying to bring to it all the questions you brought up in the introduction. That is, how did millions of people feed themselves in a place where a few thousand people have a hard time feeding themselves today? And that's been one of our long-term questions with a lot of our colleagues and friends over these years.
And before we go any further, why is it that a few thousand people struggle to feed themselves in this exact same region today? What's different for them?
That's a really interesting question, too. Partly it's because what we're seeing is a small portion of the kind of farming that happened in the past. And we're seeing mainly in a lot of the areas that are deforested and where there's farming today, what is generally called swidden or slash and burn agriculture, which is a form of agriculture which is ingenious and remarkable and provides the major crops that people live off of, but it has very low yields commonly, and yields that aren't large enough to feed millions of people. And there's always a question in the past before about, well, was it all this so-called slash and burn, this swidden agriculture, or the term commonly used in the Maya world, the milpa agriculture?
Where they go in and clear cut trees and then plant in that area?
And they plant in those areas and they get, you know, nice but low yield crops of corn and beans and squash and a few other things around it and fruit trees and so on.
Okay.
So, but then we start finding, you know, things like this square kilometer, almost a square mile or so of these canals. And then we thought, well, so they're also doing canal agriculture.
Meaning like they're somehow diverting water in irrigation.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Because
is there a river nearby or where's the water coming from?
It's right on this wonderful river called the Rio Bravo, which is a beautiful tropical river. And it's perennial, flows all year long. But the other thing we have to think about in this Maya world that commonly people don't think about is that there's a really strong dry season. So 4 or 5 months of very dry conditions. And it's very difficult to grow crops during that time period, especially if the dry season continues on. Now, good local farmers know how to do it. They plant at the end of the dry season and wait for the rains, but the rains don't always come, so sometimes their crops don't work. But if you have a wetland, you can divert water into it, and you have a perennial water table, and you could grow throughout the year, or at least especially during the dry season when the uplands aren't producing because they don't have the irrigation water in the uplands away from where that water table is. And so we've known about that for a long time, but it was only in 2006 where we got this LIDAR survey over this broad area.
Where you flew this plane, and the plane, this special radar, has it shoots lasers down at the surface of the...
It absolutely does.
Okay.
And they map the surface with a resolution accuracy of 10, 15, 20 centimeters.
And it's able to see through the trees?
Well, so it sees through gaps in the trees, and it finds out, you know, you find out that there are a lot more gaps in the forest than you think they are, and as these beams are getting down through it, and it allows you to map the surface, but it also allows you to map the whole forest too. So some of my students are really more ecologists, and they're studying the biomass within this forest too, to get at questions like carbon sequestration, how much carbon's in that environment.
I see.
And so we've got a bunch of students working on that stuff too.
So this LIDAR results then from this airplane that flew over this whole vast area was able to show you what exactly underneath the trees.
Yeah. And well, it was surprising to us because we worked in that area, as I said, laboriously climbing out along these trails, you know, and cutting machete trails, and we'd find a canal here and evidence for Maya agriculture here and there. But then this was able to map, just in the one area we'd worked in, 5 times more canal field systems. But then through the whole system, it discovered whole new wetland field complexes that we'd never seen before that were actually even larger. And so, you know, a small watershed had, as far as we can tell so far, 14 square kilometers of this wetland farming.
Had they created, so like rice paddies, had they created this wetland area by somehow diverting the river onto these lands?
Well, it's interesting you bring it up because the people who are there now are indigenous Maya people. But there's also a strong, very strong and large group of Mennonites farmers there who are very modern technology oriented. And they're doing it right now, too. They're actually diverting the river for rice production right now, actual rice production. The ancient Maya were focused on corn production. And, you know, those are two of the great starches that produce most of the food in the world, rice and corn. And they're now together producing those things. But the ancient Maya were mainly producing corn, but with a lot of other crops that we're finding evidence for too, but in a much larger area in the past. And it does begin to tell us, you know, more about how you fed hundreds of thousands of people, million people, rather than just that squid in agriculture we talked about.
So what was exactly their magical agricultural trick? They weren't cutting the forests down. They were, digging canals?
They did have to cut parts of the forest down. There's no doubt about that. But they built massive groups of canals that are tremendously rectilinear. So they're very linear. When you look at these things...
It's like graph paper. It's all very...
I'm sorry, I didn't say it very well. So they did have to cut sections of the forest down, and they built these canals that are very linear, so very like lines going mm-hmm. north, south, east, west. And when you look at them, you see this remarkable grid pattern. So, you know, they surveyed them very well when they were building them. Not all of them are like that, but a lot of them are. And so what you're getting at then are canals separating fields. And in the fields, they're growing... We know a whole bunch of the typical crops that I mentioned before, the corn or maize, the squash, the beans. But they're probably also growing, we have evidence for this, cassava or manioc, if you've ever heard that before. It's this mm-hmm. big tuber that produces a huge amount of starch and can feed a lot of places. It's one of the most important crops today in Africa, although it came from the New World.
Mm-hmm.
It came from the Neotropics, in fact.
And so why is it, obviously, you're getting closer to an understanding that, yes, maybe these Mayan communities really were gigantic, like we had once thought they were. Are there lessons for the way the Maya were farming that could be used today? Or is there some takeaway, do you think, from understanding just how advanced they were in their agricultural practices?
Well, I think there's a lot of takeaways. The first was they were very productive. They adapted as population grew from less intensive forms of agriculture to much more intensive forms of agriculture, like these wetland field complexes. But the other thing, another interesting takeaway as well, is that they built these wetlands when water table rose, and some areas that had been dry before became wet, and they had to adapt in that case too. And our evidence is showing that they were farms when they were dry lands, and then the wetlands came along, and they adapted to these wetlands too. So in some cases, there's a natural environmental hazard that occurred with sea level rise and water table rise that made former areas that were dry into wetlands.
And what did they do to adapt to that? Just drain the water out?
To it, yeah. So they drained the water out. But the other thing to think about as well is they drain the water out, but they also manage the water to stay in during certain times and also to produce protein, because we have lots of evidence for they're using lots of mollusks and fish and turtles and anything else that would grow in those areas. Because and that seems to be a major source of their protein, although we need to do a lot more work on it. What we find about all these things is there's lots of evidence for the gathering of those mollusks of many kinds there, too.
So often we think about ancient peoples as being kind of more in tune with, you know, and leaving less of a footprint than we in modern society leave on the planet. But this is a situation of a civilization that's very hands-on in shaping the land. What does that tell us?
Yeah, I think it is. And the more and more you look at it, the more and more you see this evidence for it. And there's now been several LIDAR studies that show these massive cities. And what I mean by causeway, I mean a big road, dam features, lots of reservoirs all over these landscapes, these mm-hmm. wetland fields or these terraced agricultures over these landscapes. These were very altered places.
And did that have consequences? I mean, do you think they experienced their own kind of human-caused climate change?
There's a couple of studies that indicates that. If you take down a forest, you're going to change the energy dynamics of solar radiation fairly strongly. We've never argued that they completely deforested those environments, but even, you know, partial deforestation can lead to decreases in rainfall as you go forward some period of time. And that can also lead to changes in temperature, too. So it's possible that they did cause some climate changes. One thing I would say, however, is that these wetland fields seem to arise during periods of drought. So not only is there the response and adaptation to water table rise, but they appear to be a response and adaptation to dry periods. You know, it's harder to grow crops up on well-drained slopes when it's a drought than it is down next to the water table. And we certainly see a correlation in time between those things.
Tim Beach is a geoarchaeologist and professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Thank you very much for sharing some of your work. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up in about 15 minutes, Maleficent, Ursula, Mother Gothel, Dolores Umbridge will look at some of the best and most terrifying female villains on screen. Just ahead, why parents should pay closer attention when their kids start whining. To Top of Mind, I'm Julie Rose. Brace yourselves for a sound that adults find universally irritating.
Daddy, I want to
Some dad posted that video of his kids whining for another cookie on YouTube. Lots of parents do that. Maybe it's cathartic to be like, can you believe what I'm dealing with over here? How do I stop my kids from whining is probably the top question parenting experts get. But Rose Sokol-Chang sees it a little differently. She studied whining at Clark University and says it's actually an important part of a child's social development, that it's even a sign of love and affection, and parents should pay attention to it. Yeah, I know. Rose Sokol-Chang now works at the American Psychological Association, and she is on the line to explain her conclusions. Hi there. Thanks so much for taking time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Being whined at by a kid until you cave to their demands certainly does not feel like a loving exchange for a parent. Why do you think it is a part of, you know, a parent-child affection?
Yeah, it seems that whines are really designed for getting attention and pulling a loved one closer to you. So while it might be something that we feel like we just want to extinguish and not hear anymore, it's actually got similar properties to baby talk, so that what some people would call annoying tone that parents use with babies to get their attention. So it's very similar in its acoustic properties, and it works about as effectively.
Oh, interesting. It's similar in what way? I mean, whining doesn't, baby talk is usually a lot like, oh, come here, little baby, what are you doing? That doesn't quite sound like whining. What's the similarity there?
It's higher pitch than other vocalizations that children use, whining is, and it has more of the sing-songy, like you just did with the moving up and down, talking to the baby, and it's more drawn out. The syllables are more drawn out, so there's more attention brought to them.
Okay, so it's an attention-getting communication on the part of the child. They could also just cry or ask nicely. Why do you think they don't do either of those things?
Well, I think parents will agree that we appreciate when our children ask nicely, when they're at different settings where they're maybe with people they're not as close to that won't love them unconditionally. So I would much rather have a child be good and well-behaved at school, where there's less leeway for them to misbehave. And so similarly, there's a lot of sounds that children could use that probably are not going to sound much different than they usually talk. So they really have to do something to get your attention when you're not paying attention to them. They have to do something different. And that's where the whining comes in.
Yeah. So do babies come pre-wired to whine, like to have this as part of their vocabulary, you know, or are they somehow learning it?
So that's a greater question that we had that I wish we could find an answer to. So it seems a lot like, since it's so similar to baby talk, that we might actually be teaching our kids to whine. So that's an interesting idea that you could measure families where there's a lot of baby talk and see if there's also a lot of whining.
So the kid is actually trying to imitate what they're hearing, the baby talk, but it comes out as whining when they do it.
It's an idea that would have to be tested, but yes, that's the idea.
Yeah, because there's, and I guess the theory there, just the underpinning would be, well, because they're so similar vocally, as you were describing, then maybe
exactly.
It is. Maybe babies are trying to baby talk and they're just getting it wrong, whining instead.
Yeah, it's definitely the sounds were more designed to be responsive to. So even baby cries are more effective when they have that high pitch, more varied pitch in that. So,
but we don't know for sure if they're learning it or if they just somehow know how to do it when they're born. Would there be an evolutionary reason why babies would be so good at learning to whine early on in their lives?
Yeah, I think it's related partly to caretakers and how we take care of human infants compared to other species infants. So humans are more likely to be cooperative breeders, which basically means there's a lot of people within the group who take care of babies. So mothers are perfectly comfortable passing a newborn infant to other women after childbirth, but you would never see that happen with a chimpanzee. They guard the babies. And so I think that since babies have been designed to be cared by so many, likewise, the vocalization is a way to keep in touch and keep in contact with a loved one, even when you're physically separated.
Oh, interesting. So other species whine then?
There are some species of monkeys that whine and even have tantrums. So they'll throw a tantrum, and while they're in the process, if it's just the mother and the infant, the mother might just ignore the tantrum. But if there's other monkeys around, then she's more likely to respond and try to stop the tantrum.
So Rose Sokol Cheng, are you saying that whining, children whining and parents responding to that, that is actually evidence of a healthy relationship?
I would say so, with the caveat that just because your child doesn't whine does not mean you don't have a healthy relationship.
Okay.
But since children are more likely to whine to caregivers and to people that they know and trust, then yes, in that sense, that I would say it's more likely to happen with a good relationship.
Oh, okay.
Where there's a strong attachment.
Right. Okay. So when you talk about whining being a sign of love and affection, part of that is just, you know, the fact that kids won't whine to a stranger usually. They're going to whine to someone who they know loves them and will respond to them. And they can, you know, they've sort of learned that this person cares enough that they'll probably cave at some point.
Exactly. Yes.
But do babies have, especially because it seems like whining is particularly prevalent, I guess, maybe in the earlier years. Is that true? Like toddler age?
Yes. So actually, cries start to get a little whiny towards the end of the first year. So baby cries are not as annoying until they get that kind of whiny tone and that nasally tone around 10 months.
Yeah.
And then once children start to acquire language, then they start to whine with words.
Okay. And then at some point, do they just grow out of it because they have their words? I mean, I know a lot of parents who are like, oh, my teenager sometimes can do it. I'd really like them to stop it. What do you think happens at a certain point in development for a child with regard to whining?
Yeah, I would say for some people, you never grow out of it. So we haven't tested it in all populations, but I definitely know people who whine to spouses and other loved ones too.
Yeah.
So it kind of peaks around that 2 to 4 years, but still keeps going into the early teens in certain situations, and definitely in more kind of stressful situations where you're reaching out.
Generally, though, does it just outlive its usefulness in the majority of children? Like they needed it before they had words, and you know, and then they were, you know, they had this bond with a parent, and they needed a lot from the parent, and maybe it's also an expression of trying to. You know, oftentimes it's the kid wants to get what they want. They're trying to express some control or some independence. But at a certain
right.
point, the kid in a relationship with a parent maybe has other strategies to approach that.
Exactly. So early on, I mean, I think there's a few things that you pointed out that matter. So one is independence. So as a toddler's learning to walk and they're getting away from the parent, you would expect at some point they're going to whine in that transaction when they're trying to get the attention, just because there's more of a gap then. They're not being carried anymore.
Mm.
And so when children grow and get even more independent, rather, there's less reason for them to be kind of checking in frequently with that secure base, with that attachment figure. So The independence matters. Then also the different strategies of being able to ask in different ways. And you hear parents more frequently, I would wager, telling a 4 or 5 or 6 year old to ask in a nice voice, whereas you wouldn't tell a 2 year old that.
So what do you think is the appropriate response if whining is actually part of a natural attachment between a parent and a child? It's one of the important vocalization tools that you've identified, in addition to crying and baby talk. Should parents, You know, because I think parents often, it's like, if I cave to what they want, they're just going to keep on doing more whining, you know, so I can't do that. Mm-hmm. Like, I got to be firm about this. I can't respond to whining. Do you think that that undermines the relationship?
Yeah, I think that you have to, the best thing you can do is try to cut it off before it happens.
Hmm.
And so the same way when a dog growls, you know, if you keep messing with it, it's going to bite you. If you start to hear early signs that the child's asking for something from you, you need to respond before it gets to the point where they're feeling like they have to whine to get your attention.
Okay.
And so you might more likely hear kids whining when you have an important phone call and you've been on the phone for 20 minutes and they've been trying to get your attention. So it's really about being sure to be responsive before it gets to that point.
Oh, interesting. So thinking about whining more as an effort to get your attention than an effort to manipulate and wear you down. Like so, you know, because maybe they're not going to get another cookie and they really want another cookie. And before you can make that clear to them again, you end up on a phone call and then the whining starts. Maybe there was a way to make it very, very clear from the get-go that the cookie thing is not happening, so that they don't feel compelled to get your attention while you're on the phone call.
Yes, or maybe there's just sometimes when you have to accept that you know better as the parent and they can't have that cookie and they're going to be really upset about it.
And
you
then
know?
You just...
And you can validate their emotions that they feel upset, but they're still not getting a cookie.
All right. Well, they might whine in that case then.
And they might whine.
And you just... And so you're really talking more about, like, there's no way to, like sort of changing as a parent, changing your mindset about whining, like trying
yes.
to not be so bothered by it if you can recognize that it's just another way that your child is communicating with you and try to interpret it.
Yes. And really, you just have to say, as with a lot of things with parenting young kids, these things will pass.
Hmm.
But at least you know for sure that they love you.
Yeah. Because they wouldn't whine to you if they didn't love you.
Yeah.
Oh, that's bitter. That's a bittersweet conclusion. But if you are thinking about whining only as, like, primarily as a way to get your attention, then maybe the response isn't to give them a cookie, but to give them attention.
Yes, exactly.
Hmm.
And so it might not be about the cookie at all. What's interesting to me is that this research was published in 2010, and people still keep reaching out to me and calling me to learn more about whining, because there actually has not been a lot of research on children's whining, and people usually treat it as a bad habit that you just need to ignore to get it to go away.
Hmm.
I think that there's a lot more attention in the last several decades on how important attachment and kind of positive approaches to parenting are to a child and parent relationship. And so my suspicion is that with the advent of these approaches, we would also find that whining and other vocalizations serve an important role in those relationships.
Rose Sokol-Chang studied whining at Clark University. She now works at the American Psychological Association. Thank you very much for sharing your work with us today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Julie.
This is Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Coming up next, ParentPreviews.com has a roundup of great female villains from Maleficent to Miranda Priestly in The Devil Wears Prada. It's great to have you along for Top of Mind. I'm Julie Rose. Why is it that Disney princesses are nearly always up against a female villain, a villainess, if you will? The evil queen, Ursula, the sea witch, one of my favorites, the wicked stepmother, and Maleficent.
Before the sun sets on her 16th birthday, she will prick her finger on the spindle of the spinning wheel.
Please don't do this.
Except for with True Love's Kiss, of course, which comes later. With the second Maleficent film out in theaters, Kirsten Hawks of ParentPreviews.com has been giving some thought to this phenomenon of the female villain. What motivates these women? Which are the most villainous and why? Hey, Kirsten, hi. Thanks so much for taking time.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, Julie. I am a fan of a good villain, and particularly a good villainess. So we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, I love it. I love the list that you've put together. Let's talk first about Maleficent, Mistress of Evil, this new film. What did you think of it?
Maleficent, Mistress of Evil is a perfectly decent family movie. It is much less dark than the first one, which had some very disturbing themes. There was a subtext about rape, paranoia, insanity. It went to some really dark places that you usually don't find in a children's movie. Mistress of Evil, on the other hand, is pretty much standard family fare. And it's fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah. Ironic, since it's called Mistress of Evil.
Yeah. Well, she's not actually the evil one in that movie. And that's the title. You know, they're kind of messing with your head a bit.
Yeah. What do you think about Maleficent as a villain?
Ooh, I really enjoy Maleficent as a villain. In the original animated film, she's just great over-the-top Disney villainous. In the live action, in the first Maleficent movie, she is a villain who is both sympathetic and ambiguous. She's sympathetic because she doesn't start out as a villain. She's a happy young fairy who becomes friends with a human, which is mistake number one. When he sees an opportunity to take the throne in his kingdom, he cuts off her wings after he has drugged her. The rape allegory is very clear.
Yeah.
And she becomes consumed with rage and vengeance. And when he is now the king and has a baby daughter, she comes and curses the child. Standard villain behavior there. But as she watches this child grow, her heart is softened and she throws herself into trying to undo her own curse.
Hmm.
So she becomes less and less of a villain, and the evil of Aurora's father, the king, becomes more clearly exposed.
Yeah. What category would you put Maleficent in then as a villain?
A revenge villain, but also an ambiguous villain.
Yeah. Are there any others in that category that you like?
The revenge ones. Well, actually, in the Maleficent sequel, Queen Ingrith is a revenge villain, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, who is cold, chilly, scheming, and who wears jewels like armor. It's her wardrobe is fascinating. She is motivated by revenge and bigotry. She hates non-humans and is setting up her own nasty little ethnic cleansing program.
Wow.
She's a chilly villain. My favorite revenge villain is Ursula from The Little Mermaid. She wants to gain revenge against King Triton for banishing her, and she wants to rule the oceans. She's so much fun. She's so campy. She's so deliciously devious. She's so va-va-voom in her villainy. She dominates every scene she's in. And I swear, she steals the movie from that vapid Little Mermaid, who is not very smart and not very interesting.
How dare you, Ariel?
Little Mermaid? She's like a 14-year-old who has daddy issues. Pat Carroll, who is the voice for Ursula, said that she scared herself when she saw the final movie. Now, Ursula might scare kids, but most adults are just going to love her.
Those poor unfortunate souls, so sad, so true. They come flocking to my cauldron, crying, spells, Ursula, please, and I help them.
Yes, I do.
Now, it's happened once or twice. Someone couldn't pay the price, and I'm afraid I had to rake them across the coals. Yes, I've had the odd complaint, but on the whole, I've been a saint to those poor unfortunate souls.
Raise a glass to Ursula, absolutely, from The Little Mermaid. So who else, Kirsten Hawkes? What other female villainesses are on your list?
Well, we're heading from rule the sea to rule the world, because that's a standard movie villain or villainous motivation. You know, the super crazy bad guys or gals who just want to have it all. We've got like Jadis, who's the White Witch in Narnia. You've got the unhinged Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland, and Hela, who's Thor's homicidal sister.
Yes. Played by Kate Blanchett. She's something else. Yeah.
And even Bellatrix Lestrange in Harry Potter, who doesn't want to rule the world herself. She wants to help her sick, noseless, murderous, nutjob leader rule the world. But I thought for our purposes, if you're looking for a fun rule the world villainous, go watch Enchanted. Susan Sarandon is having a marvelous time playing the evil queen Nerissa, who follows Amy Adams, very ditzy Princess Giselle, out of the animated kingdom of Andalasia and into the real grubby, messy, painful world. When Nerissa shows up in the final action scene at a costume ball with a poisoned apple and turns herself into a dragon, it's so much fun. It's such a great moment.
I'm speaking with Kirsten Hawks of ParentPreviews.com. We're talking female villains because Maleficent, the new Maleficent movie, is out, and also just because we can. So we've talked about revenge-motivated villains. We've talked about rule-the-world villains. What else? What other categories do you see out there?
One of the most interesting categories for female villainesses is the ones who are obsessed with beauty and youth. This drives them to murder, various forms of parasitism. They're just really interesting. If these villainesses are familiar to anyone who spent their childhood, like I did, curled up with books of fairy tales.
Wait, what do you mean, before we get into, or I guess maybe as you're explaining some examples, what do you mean by parasitism?
They suck youth, beauty, and sometimes even life out of other people just to maintain eternally young and beautiful.
Oh, okay. So that's definitely the evil queen as portrayed in some of the Snow White movies, like more not the Disney fairy tale version, but that Snow White and the Hunter film, right, that had Kristen Smith in it.
Yeah, Snow White and the Huntsman. That's a PG-13 movie. Kristen Stewart is the Snow
White
character.
Stewart, thank you. How dare I get the names wrong. Kristen
and
Stewart.
Charlize Theron plays the dauntingly beautiful Queen Ravenna. She uses dark and evil magic to literally suck the life and beauty out of young and lovely women in the kingdom. Compared to that, the animated Wicked Queen in Snow White, who, you know, just tries to kill her stepdaughter because she's jealous, she's small potatoes. Queen Ravenna is a much darker villainess.
Here's a quick clip from that film, Snow White and the Hunter. Is that what it's called, Snow White?
The Huntsman.
And the Huntsman. Here is Charlize Theron as the evil queen.
Beauty is my power. Mirror, mirror on the wall. Who is fairest of them all?
You are the fairest, but there is another destined to surpass you.
Snow White, of course. So I'm a little conflicted, Kristen Hawks, about this kind of villainess, because she says there, beauty is my power. And as if that's a bad thing, right? And I guess in our society, in modern, obviously it's bad to like suck the life out of other people or to like have to be the fairest of them all, right? So it can go too far. But the idea that you know, that feminine wiles exist, or that women would sort of not be afraid to you know, embrace their femininity. Like, there's all kinds of stuff to chew on there when it comes to our culture and what messages we send to children, to little girls especially, about, you know, whether it's okay to be beautiful or to want to be beautiful, and what that means, and what power that gives you as a woman.
Well, and it's worth noting that in that world, that was a woman's, really her only path to power. But I think we also want to look about how in our culture we as women use beauty. Do we use it to intimidate or control others? Do we create artificially perfect images of ourselves that we put on social media to make other people jealous or to establish ourselves in a social pecking order? Snow White and the Huntsman is not a children's movie. It's a PG-13 for a reason. It's extremely violent. That being said, it is a really good movie to watch with teenagers if you want to have discussions about these issues around beauty, power, how we see ourselves, how we treat others.
Any other villains in this beauty, youth-obsessed, parasitical genre that maybe are appropriate for kids if we want to go there?
Yeah, and one of the scariest Disney villains, the one who frightened me probably more than any other, is Mother Gothel in Disney's Rapunzel film Tangled. This is a viscerally frightening film because Gothel abducts Rapunzel out of her crib as an infant, tearing her family apart and inflicting enormous psychological damage on the child for the most selfish of reasons. Rapunzel has magical hair, which can heal injuries and provide perpetual youth and beauty to those who touch it on a regular basis. Gothel feigns affection for the girl, raises her as her own daughter, but imprisons her in a tower, belittles, demeans, and manipulates her solely to keep Gothel young forever. If you've ever known anyone who had a parent with narcissistic behavioral issues, this movie and Donna Murphy's chilling performance will make your blood run cold. It's really scary.
So interesting to hear you talk about a Disney cartoon like that. We do have a clip from one of Mother Gothel's song and dance performances in the tower with the young Rapunzel.
Mother knows best. Take it from your mumsy. On your own, you won't survive. Sloppy, underdressed, immature, clumsy, please. They'll eat you up alive. Gullible, naive, positively grubby, ditzy, and a bit, well, vague. Plus, I believe, getting kind of chubby. I'm just saying, cause I love you. Mother understands. Mother's here to help you. All I have is one request.
Rapunzel?
Yes?
Don't ever ask to leave this tower again.
Yes, Mother.
Oh, I love you very much, dear.
I love you more.
So awful the way she's in that happy up singing tone. Really, you know, you're getting a little chubby, really undermining Rapunzel's self-confidence and, you know, but just straight up gaslighting her, basically lying about everything.
I watched this movie with my daughter when she's a little girl, and I was horrified. I'm like, this is the most awful Disney villain I think I've ever seen.
Well, Kirsten Hawkes, are there any other categories of female villain that are interesting to you?
The realistic female villain. These are villains who have behaviors that we actually see around us. They might be in a magical or a setting that doesn't quite apply to our daily lives, but there's something about them that's scary. Really, what's really scary about them is that their particular forms of evil aren't imaginative.
Give me an example. Real.
Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, and she also shows up again in the final film as well. She's played by Imelda Staunton with chirpy, chipper, dauntless evil. She's very scary.
What is it that makes her so scary? I mean, is she like what's her motivation? How is she being evil?
Dolores Umbridge, to my mind, exemplifies what Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil. She is a bureaucrat. She's a toady who uses an ideology based on bigotry and hate and superiority as an excuse to break the law, trample on wizarding tradition, and even torture a child, Harry Potter, who speaks out against her while she remains encased in her own sense of personal rectitude. She treads the same path that civil servants in Germany walked. I'm not a Nazi, but, and then carried out an unjust law. And the path walked by anyone today whose sense of cultural or racial superiority blinds them to the dignity of other human beings and makes it possible to watch them suffer without caring about their pain. Dolores Umbridge is terrifying because she walks among us and we see her evil around us.
I think this is maybe the first encounter that Harry and his classmates have with their new instructor in Defense of the Dark Arts.
They've seen her at the banquet, but it's their first class with her.
Okay. Dolores Umbridge in Harry Potter. Let's have a listen.
It is the view of the Ministry that a theoretical knowledge will be sufficient to get you through your examinations, which, after all, is what school is all about.
And how's theory supposed to prepare us for what's out there?
There is nothing out there, dear. Who do you imagine wants to attack children like yourself?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Lord Voldemort.
Now, let me make this quite plain. You have been told that a certain dark wizard is at large once again. This is a lie.
It's not a lie. I saw him. I fought
him. Detention, Mr. Potter.
So according to you, Cedric Diggory dropped dead of his own accord.
Cedric Diggory's death was a tragic accident.
It was murder. Voldemort killed him. You must know that.
Enough! Enough. See me later, Mr. Potter. My office.
A clip there from Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, introducing Dolores Umbridge and all her realistic scariness, according to Kirsten Hawk.
Oh, yeah. She gives Pink a bad name, Kitten a bad name, Boucle a bad name.
Anybody else? Any other realistically scary villains on your list?
Meryl Streep's portrayal of Miranda Priestly in Devil Wears Prada.
Okay.
I had a boss like her once.
Oh, that's a... Remind us what Miranda Priestly is like as a boss.
Horrible. She apparently was modeled off of Anna Wintour, who's the editor of Vogue. So she runs the top end fashion magazine. She is a perfectionist, a hard-hearted, sharp-tongued perfectionist who treats her employees like they are disposable human trash. Hmm. She is unfeeling, selfish, and makes wild and irrational demands of her employees and demonstrates no gratitude when they pull off things that literally look impossible.
So here's an example of that from the film The Devil Wears Prada. Anne Hathaway's character, who is the much put upon assistant to Miranda Priestly, has just actually pulled off one of these impossible tasks. She's gotten an advance copy of the latest Harry Potter book for Miranda Priestly, Meryl Streep's character, for her twin daughters. And so in walks Anne Hathaway and drops this advance copy on the desk of the boss.
One copy. What are my twins going to do with that? Share?
No, I made two copies and had them covered, reset, and bound so that they wouldn't look like manuscripts. This is an extra copy to have in file, you know, just in case.
Well, where are these fabulous copies? I don't see them anymore.
They're with the twins. On the train on the way to Grandma's. Is there anything else I can do for you?
Mm-mm. That's all.
Okay.
So what's the evil in that realistic villain, Kirsten Hawk?
Selfishness unchecked. Arrogance, a disregard for others, a disdain for the feelings of others, a worship of the fleeting and transient over the things that really matter. There is an ugliness at the heart of Miranda that can't be covered up with her exquisite taste or the perfectionism that she values. Miranda is us whenever we fall into the same traps. That's why she's so scary.
Kristen Hawks, do you have any thoughts on how female villains are portrayed as opposed to male villains? Do you see any distinctions there?
Oh, I've been debating this point with my kids. female villains are usually sexier, usually skinnier, better looking, and sometimes they might actually exploit their looks or their sexuality to a greater degree than male villains. Male villains usually have more brute force and raw power, although Captain Marvel is a bit of an exception to that. She's clearly the most powerful Avenger. Male villains are more likely to be crazed psychopaths and serial killers. And I don't think leaving women out of that necessarily makes me feel bad or overlooked. I had been convinced that the narcissistic beauty motif was an exclusively female villain trait. But then my son pointed out to me the movie version of The Portrait of Dorian Gray, which stars Ben Barnes, who has some sort of demonic pact that... gives him an evil bargain that gives him eternal youth and beauty, and he murders to keep the secret. So I guess that's not an exclusively female form of evil. So I think any good villain, male or female, is going to be a little bit complex. And I think that's what makes for a good villain, a good character, a good story, and ultimately a good film. If you have a villain who is interesting, whether they're male or female, and if they're fun, so much the better.
Kirsten Hawks reviews films at parentpreviews.com. Thanks a lot for taking time. Lots of stuff to watch villains for Halloween. I appreciate your insight.
Yes. Nothing like a good villain for Halloween.
And speaking of Halloween, be sure to get your questions in for our food scientist on Halloween. Our food scientist will be answering your questions about artificial colors and flavors. Because let's face it, everything your kids eat around Halloween is loaded with that stuff. Did you know some countries have actually banned certain artificial colors that are still really common in the U.S.? What do you wonder about these extras that make our treats so tasty and colorful? We want to know your questions so we can get you some answers. Tell us what you want to know on social media. We are at BYU Top of Mind. Or you can leave your question in a voicemail on our hotline, and we might even play that on the air. That number is 855-242-8298. Again, that number, 855-242-8298, to leave us your question in a voicemail, or send us an email, topofmind@byu.edu. Get those questions to us now so we can get your answers on Halloween. That's it for Top of Mind. We're a production of BYU Radio. Cole Wissinger engineers the program. Rod Gustafson and Ciara Hewlett produce the show with help from John Barrett, Angela Cava, Joe Carson, Amy Colton, Sam Faulkner, Martha Harris, Haley Kendall, Zach Lautensock, Scott Nielsen, Jasper Rains, and Kyle Raymond. I'm Julie Rose. We'll talk soon.